money in the world cannot stop the rising tides, at least not unless we get serious about trying to stop rising sea level. That is the focus of our first segment. I'm Betsy Rosenberg, and welcome to The Green Front, where we'll be talking with author John Englander about his timely new book called High Tide on Main Street, Rising Sea Level and the Coming Coastal Crisis. He'll tell us in plain English what we can expect over the coming months, years, and decades, and beyond along America's coastlines. In our second half, we'll look at what the tide is washing up on our beaches, in a word, plastics. You'll meet a couple who have spent years trash walking, making art out of colorful plastic debris and sending a graphic message about our wasteful culture and how garbage really does not ever go away. Very excited about today's show. John Englander is pretty prophetic. That was prophetic, not pathetic. He's a genius, actually, because he predicted exactly what happened with Hurricane Sandy. And not only that, but his book, High Tide on Main Street, came out just a week before that superstorm hit the Atlantic coast. So very pleased to have someone as wise and knowledgeable as John. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Betsy.
This is reminding me in an eerie way of when I interviewed Mike Tidwell shortly after Hurricane Katrina. He had written a book about the erosion of the Louisiana coastline, pretty much predicting what happened with Hurricane Katrina, and it seems like this is happening again with your book. I mean, it was perhaps somewhat, you know, a stroke of luck, good or bad, depending on your perspective, that your book came out right before, and on a certain page in the book, 121, you really kind of sketched a scene of pretty much what happened in New York City and along the coast there. But it also, you know, was the result of years, if not decades, of work on your part. So tell us how, you know, how long it's been that you have seen this problem rising, if you will, pardon the expression, and what we can expect in the future, especially if we don't address the issues. And, of course, at the core, at least part of it is caused by climate change, but there could be other factors at work as well, which is what we're going to be focusing on during the segment.
Sure, glad to. The chapter 12 in the book was giving a couple of dozen examples to show that between long-term sea level rise, the when it happens at high tide or extreme high tide, lunar high tide, as happened with Sandy, and when there is a storm surge event, and then when certain geologic features, all of which were present in New York, come together, that the additive effects are far greater than anybody would expect. And it was an example. I wasn't predicting what happened in any given time frame, but it was one of dozens of examples. The other, you know, surprising examples include Boston Harbor and Sacramento and places that people just don't consider. They tend to think of sea level rise and erosion as events for Miami or the Bahamas or the Maldives or places like that. And it was to bring it home to say that every coastal city in the world, literally, from Seattle to Monaco to Manila to Shanghai to Singapore, and all cities I mentioned in the book, are vulnerable. The bigger picture that brought me to this, and how long I've been studying it, I guess, it started in college, I hate to say 40 years ago, when I was fascinated that with the rise and fall of the ice ages, or glacial periods that we've all heard about and even have kids' movies about today, that with the ice ages, when there's 2 miles of ice on the northern hemisphere, that as that melts, sea level rises 300 or 400 feet. And I thought that was fascinating. But the time scale of most glacial period changes is so slow that there was no possibility that in our lifetimes that sea level would change much, because it's really very, very gradual. But there is this cycle of every 100,000 years, roughly, when the ocean goes up and down 300 or 400 feet. And what was interesting is that we've had 6,000 years of sea level, of level seas, when the ocean really hasn't changed much, which means the shoreline hasn't moved much. The fact that our entire civilization only goes back about 6,000 or 8,000 years of recorded human history, and that's our perspective, meant that we just assumed that that's where the beach would always be and the shoreline would always be. But when you look back geologically, you realize we've had a brief moment of time, a plateau. But again, I didn't think it would change in my lifetime until about 20 years ago, when global warming was first observed, when Jim Hansen gave his apocryphal talk testimony to the U.S. Congress, I think it was 1988, and the world began studying climate change and how quickly it could escalate. So fast forward, over the last 15 years, I guess, I've gotten intently interested in it. And as I was explaining and studying climate change for myself with my oceanographic background, but trying to explain it to others, I suddenly realized that sea level was the lens through which we could look at climate change, which is very confusing. The climate change is very confusing, and sea level becomes a clear lens because it's this simple. The Earth does change temperatures naturally. There are climate cycles like ice ages, but we've changed the cycle now. And the simple truth is that sea level moves up and down 400 and even 600 feet over long periods of time, millions of years, as the ice ages come and go. And that's the best proof of long-term temperature change, because ice melts at 32 degrees Fahrenheit, whether you're Republican or Democrat. As I say, it doesn't really matter what your political beliefs. We all know that a block of ice melts at a certain temperature, and depending upon the heat will determine how much of the block remains. So sea level change, which is easy to see in ancient beach lines, which are underwater. I mean, I've explored them for years in both diving when I was living in the Bahamas and in submarines off Hawaii even last year, finding ancient shorelines that are now 200 or 300 feet below sea level, because that's when the ice sheets extended far below today's level and sea level was down. So it becomes a great picture. And what we now can see, and Sandy began to open the door for some people, is that coastal change will happen with long-term sea level rise. We've had a foot of sea level rise in New York over the last century. When it hits at high tide, when a storm surge hits, when it hits at high tide or extreme high tide, and then in certain places where there are what I call geologic and topographic features that amplify the effect. And New York was the perfect example, because Long Island and New Jersey form a broad funnel shape. And as I describe, when a storm hits Atlantic City, the right flank of the hurricane, if it comes from the southeast to northwest, which it did, will pile up the water in that funnel, and even more so because there's a shallow underwater plate offshore. So all of that was just a good example of what can happen.
The perfect storm, if you will. And the cover, speaking of picture, the cover of your book, there's a yellow sign, like a traffic sign, that says high tide on Main Street. In water, but it's not mainstream like a small town, USA. You happen to have it, you know, that sign surrounded by high-rises, it looks like. It really looks eerily like Manhattan. What were you thinking when you were seeing the pictures on television as the damage began to be known, and also hearing that water was, you know, gushing into subway tunnels and roadway tunnels, and did it feel, I'm sure... maybe underneath you felt vindicated, but I'm sure you were horrified, like the rest of us as well.
It's absolutely true. You know, the cover was designed back in June and was selected out of about 107 entries that were done in an online contest, and it struck me it was just a very appealing cover. Never, of course, imagining Sandy. And as you describe very accurately, I mean, I watched in horror that week. I live in Florida, and Sandy did some damage when it went up across Florida, but we all knew it was aiming for the New York, New Jersey area. And I watched in horror with everybody else. And truthfully, we went to sleep that Monday night knowing it was going to happen, and it was Tuesday morning when we all watched the scenes. And frankly, well, I said, well, this is kind of the effect I was describing, and just far worse in some ways because of the timing with the full moon high tide, et cetera. It was about 10 o'clock that morning when it really hit me, and it was because I was just as stunned as everybody else. I said, wait a minute, John. I said, not only did you describe that, I had to go find the page. It was 121, but the cover does look like that scene. And I was just as amazed by that fortuitous timing of a terrible event and how it accentuated the timeliness of my book, and hopefully get people to read the two dozen other examples.
And how's the book done since it has turned out to be so timely? Just getting out?
It's not backed by a major publisher, and there's no big promotional campaign. It's radio shows like yours and word of mouth, but it's sold thousands of copies already, and it's been out literally not quite 3 months. So really, I'm told that's extremely successful for basically an independent book.
And in a weird way, of course, you probably have Hurricane Sandy to thank for that, but not really. No one could be thankful for that devastating storm. By the way, you know, the victims of which are still suffering and, you know, only now going to be beginning to get the financial compensation that they've been needing and asking for. But you say you live in Florida, and you also say that there's going to be totally different situations for sea level rise in Miami, let's say, versus Manhattan. How so?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I understood the gist of the question. Please just repeat that.
Oh, this is actually one of the questions on your book sheet. It says why Miami and Manhattan are totally different situations for sea level rise. So I was just picking up on that.
Thank you. Yeah, even in like Al Gore's movie and many other documents, they talk about Miami and Manhattan as being similarly vulnerable to sea level rise, and using examples of what happens with like 20 feet or 6 meters of sea level rise. They're totally different situations, and it's a great teaching opportunity. Miami is 6 feet above sea level at best, and it's porous limestone. Even if you put a steel seawall around Miami, it wouldn't matter, because as the ocean rises, it would just percolate up through the rock like a sponge, which it does now when we have extreme tides and storm surge. So Miami is for that purpose, unprotectable against rising seas. Manhattan, contrary to first impression perhaps, is not a beachfront island, of course. It's an average of 54 feet above sea level. It goes up to over 200 feet above sea level, and it's made out of granite. So while there are vulnerable spots on Manhattan in the lower portions particularly, even there it's typically a 10-foot drop to the water. At the worst case, it's 5-foot. But seawalls and other reinforcements and hardening can do wonders for Manhattan. And given the density of real estate in Manhattan, Manhattan will be there 100 years from now, even if we have 10 feet higher sea level. It's protectable. Miami is not. So there, it's sad for Miami, and I can live in Florida. But adapting in South Florida is going to be much more challenging. We're going to have to raise buildings, setbacks, and come up with some really innovative technology if Miami is to be a viable city on, you know, even 50 years from now.
And yet you say devastating economic effects will not just be limited to the coast.
No, but for two reasons. That if you think that most of our society worldwide is on the coast because of transportation, beauty, fisheries, weather, all the obvious appeals of the coastal regions, and it's clear as you go around the world that and for transportation, you know, and all the other resources that people do gravitate toward the coast. First of all, it's the great bulk of our investment in infrastructure, both personally and for businesses and communities and governments, et cetera. But it's also the ports where we bring goods in. Even if you live in Denver, a mile above sea level, your goods coming through the port of Los Angeles or the port of Long Beach or Seattle or Vancouver or New York or wherever. And as those ports are disrupted by sea level, which they never planned for when they designed the ports, if the fuel which comes ashore to the refineries, to the shipping terminals, is affected. We saw both from Sandy and also with the tragedy in Japan with the tsunami, which is not a climate event, but we saw how storm surge and extreme on top of extreme tides, on top of sea level rise, which is going to go decade after decade after decade for centuries, it's going to put infrastructure at risk that nobody ever designed for. Most harbors are designed for a 3-foot change of tide daily, and then the extreme tides of another, you know, foot or two. Nobody contemplated, and this just doesn't apply to ports where we bring in commercial goods for Walmart or fuel. This applies to Navy bases and all the goods we ship worldwide. And so it's a profound impact, and no matter where you live, you will be impacted as coastal cities are threatened by storm surge, sea level rise, when it happens at high tides, and where there are ports from Boston to New York to Charleston to Long Beach to Vancouver to Seattle, et cetera, Galveston, that just never intended or never expected that sea level could rise dramatically this century. I told the story in the book, and it's absolutely true. When I studied these old sea levels, paleo sea levels 40 years ago, it was inconceivable that the Arctic would be ice-free this century. It had been frozen for 3 million years. It will be ice-free in September, sometime between 2016 and 2030, because it's melting faster and faster. Most people have seen images of that. But to show you the degree of misunderstanding, most people think the melting Arctic is why sea level is rising. It has no effect because it's floating sea ice. It's like ice cubes in a glass. the sea level rise.
I learned that from Al Gore's training. Very graphic, simple, but kind of important distinction.
Right. The oceans are warming, and so they're getting higher by a few inches. But the real problem was that it happens in Greenland and Antarctica, where 99% of the world's fresh water is locked up.
And what is happening with Greenland right now? How fast is the rate of melt?
It's in runaway melt mode. I mean, last summer they had record melts, believed not to have happened for thousands of years. Most of the island was melting way beyond seasonal norms. I was there in 2007, and there were about 100 of these vertical chimneys that had been carved by the meltwater, bringing the water down through the ice sheets, down to the bottom of the glaciers, and it really accelerating the glaciers moving to the ocean. And by last summer, there were 1,000 of those vertical chimneys called moulins. So in 5-6 years, we've had a 10 times increase in the number of these. It's not an opinion, it's a physical vertical shaft that rivers of meltwater are pouring down to the base of this glacier and doubling the speed now of glaciers moving to the ocean. And of course, it's the water that adds to the ocean level, but then it's the icebergs break off from the glaciers. As icebergs enter the ocean, they do raise the ocean level. It's like adding ice cubes to a glass, as opposed to the ice cubes floating in the glass and melting. So it's the opposite effect. So it is exactly the amount of ice in Greenland and Antarctica that are the issue. And if Greenland melts entirely, which can't happen this century, can't happen for several centuries at least, maybe 1,000 years, but ocean levels would rise 24 foot worldwide. If Antarctica melts, it'd be 7 times that. But again, that won't happen for many, many centuries, probably several thousand years. But even if we have 5 or 10 feet of sea level rise this century, it's a disaster. And the point is, we need to worry about greenhouse gases, but we're past the point of no return in terms of the amount of heat we've already absorbed. The oceans are going to rise for 1,000 years. There's enough heat stored in the ocean to melt the ice that there's no way getting back to an equilibrium point from where we are, that we are going to have further melting. The sea level is going to rise, which means the shoreline is going to move inland. So here's the bottom line. We need to begin adapting to a shoreline that's moving inland for the first time in 6,000 years. It's an entire culture change to how we view the shore.
So what can we expect? Limitations, I imagine, on coastal flood insurance and even abilities, for our government to rebuild and to respond and to repair, but also what's going to happen to coastal property values and when?
Well, you've asked three great questions, and I think you're exactly right on all three. We have grown up, and when I say not just our generation, our parents, but our entire civilization, believing that property is permanent because the shoreline didn't move. Well, that was because of the 6,000-year hiatus or intermission of changing sea levels. Now that sea levels are rising and will continue and accelerate for centuries to come, we have to realize that coastal property has a finite life, and we're going to need to begin to depreciate that, knowing that land on the coast, no matter where it is not like land in Colorado that's permanent, that sea levels will rise foot by foot by foot. So we're going to see a loss of coastal property values very gradually. It may be 1% or 2% a year, but it's going to be inexorable over the next century or two. The second thing, that's the most profound economic impact. And I think that's going to just accentuate to all of us how dramatic this change is, that we're literally going to have to redraw boundaries. But how do you move Miami? How do you move ports all around the world? The Bay Area, as you know, has a tremendous vulnerability. I mean, lots of maps have been done about that. But again, Seattle, Boston, we don't think about how vulnerable we are because sea level hasn't changed much.
Now, those who are maybe, 5 feet above the waterline, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, happen to own a house on the water, but it's 30 feet above the water. Should we be concerned anytime soon about our, home value going down, or, are people just going to start looking ahead and saying anything on the coast, is not going to have the same value pretty soon here?
I don't think so. When you're looking at economic terms, it's counterintuitive, but most people, you might like to think your property is permanent and you'll leave it to your kids or in your estate or whatever, if you can get value out of something for 30 to 50 years, it's a pretty good deal. It gets into a very subtle psychology and economic valuations and how we judge things. But if you can get 50 years, you're probably in good shape. Even if you're depreciating things by a percent or two a year, things will stay in balance. So if you're 30 feet above the water, you have no problem because you can't get that much sea level rise in a century. Not possible. I mean,
right.
The current forecast for 3 to 6 feet, and I think we might get 5 to 10 feet, but that's the worst case.
I just wondered if the sociological, psychological, you know, impacts, people just seeing, you know, oh, it's near the water, better not, could happen faster than anyone
might predict. The ability of the water is going to overcome that, I think. I think that if you have, because the water is so appealing, we're not going to quickly abandon the coast. What we're going to realize is it's not permanent. It needs to be gradually discounted, unless it gets inundated like happened with Sandy. But then the two other points you raised besides the valuation are coastal flood insurance. We're going to realize pretty quickly that we shouldn't be subsidizing coastal flood insurance, which encourages people to build on the coast. And the second corollary to that that you also mentioned is that right now, with Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans and now with Hurricane Sandy in New York, New Jersey, we have a, if you will, governmental policy that the government should come in and rebuild or reimburse and get things going again. And that makes sense if it's a tornado that's unexpected or a tsunami that's unexpected and has nothing to do with climate. But when it's due to sea level rise, which is going to build inch by inch, foot by foot for 1,000 years and put all coastal land permanently underwater, not to be reversed for at least thousands of years, it's a different deal than a hurricane which comes in and does damage and you can rebuild, or even a tsunami. And we have to get our heads around that. And a few people in New York and New Jersey are starting to ask that question. I know because they've consulted with me, but because they're trying to figure out how do sea level rise and storm surge and tidal surges, how do they overlap and what's the lessons to be learned? But most people aren't talking about that yet. But we're going to figure it out pretty quickly because think about this. The big federal budget debate and the fiscal cliff finally found a little success in the last 30 days because they found an extra $50 or $60 billion to save. And what was the cost of rebuilding from Hurricane Sandy that was passed this week by Congress?
$50 billion,
first down payment. So it was a perfect example that nature can take away overnight the savings which we've struggled for a year to find in our federal budget.
Good point.
Now,
couple minutes left. I want to ask you, you know, what we can do about this. You talk about something you call intelligent adaptation.
Thank you. In the book, in one of the chapters, I say, you know, let's just get real about it. Sea level is rising. We can slow it or speed it up, but we can't eliminate it. So we need to look at the shoreline differently. Intelligent adaptation, as I've drafted it, says, first of all, look at the big picture. If you know where it's going over the long term, you can take better actions in the short term. In other words, if you know that sea level is going to rise foot after foot, you'll design things differently. Two is we need to expect or realize that there's a range to projections, and the fact that the projection range right now may be 2 feet to 4 feet this century, but every few years those projections seem to get increased as the ice melts quicker, doesn't mean we should sit there and arguing forever or disputing it any more than we do about interest rates or inflation rates or anything else. There's always a range to projections. We should begin to act based upon the best projections available. We also need to realize that different areas are different, like the Miami-New York example we talked about. The fourth thing is we need to realize that governments, as we said, aren't going to be able to bail us out forever. It's just not possible. There's not enough money in the world for any government of any country to reimburse their citizens and their economy for what's lost by the permanent and predictable loss of coastal real estate. Not possible. And then the last of the 5 points is the other one you raised, which is that we need to realize that sooner or later, coastal values will recognize that that land is no longer permanent. It's more like leasehold land. It has a finite life, whether it's 50 years or 150 years. And that's a fundamental difference in the way we look at it, because when people look at their investments or businesses, you know, whether it be gold or bonds or stocks or real estate, they always say real estate, that's permanent. Well, New Jersey taught us something. You can go buy some pretty good deals on coastal real estate right now in New Jersey because people are saying, when will it happen again?
Mm. Well, that is the question, and what we can certainly say is it will happen again, and thank you for making us certain of that, John Englander. I should have mentioned at the top that you are an oceanographer, a geologist, and an explorer, and I would add to that a bit of a psychic, although based on science. So thank you for your very timely book, your contributions. I'm sure you're going to be, if not already, in very high demand as a consultant. I hope that people are taking this seriously now. It sounds like we are, as a country, starting to wake up and smell the carbon and take another look at our coastlines.
Well, thanks for bringing attention to it. The book has a website, hightideandmainstreet.com, where there's reviews and more information, a place to order it, and it's available for e-books and audiobooks as well. So thank you.
Thank you, John. And in our next segment, we'll be looking at what the tide brings in and washes up on the shore. Plastic. It's not just debris. It can also be a form of art, but there's a message behind it. We'll find out all about that right after these quick messages.